Hey everyone, and welcome to Orbital Minds, the podcast where we explore big ideas in aerospace, innovation, and everything in between. I'm Lieutenant Colonel Josh Isom, United States Air Force.
And I'm Matthew Fryer, a major in the United States Air Force.
And I'm Kenny Jenkins, also a major United States Air Force. And today we're diving into a book by Lori Garver, Escaping Gravity, My Quest to Transform NASA and Launch a New Space Age. Buckle up, this one's all rocket fuel and revolution. To begin with, all opinions expressed here are our own and are not necessarily representative of the Department of Defense, the Air Force, or any other affiliated organizations. This is one episode in a series of discussions we and our classmates are recording about space power and space strategy as a part of our Spring 2025 Space Power course at the School of Advanced Air and Space Studies. With that said, Josh, can you introduce our author?
Lori Garver isn't just a space nerd with an opinion. She was NASA's deputy administrator under President Obama and a key figure in shifting the agency from an aging, government-led model to one that embraces commercial partnerships with companies like SpaceX and Blue Origin. This book is part memoir, part political expose, and part roadmap for the future of space, and she doesn't hold back.
The book is structured into three parts: gravity, force, and motion. Each one walks us through Garver's journey in the systemic battle she fought inside and outside NASA. She starts in the 1980s with a pretty unconventional background, no astronaut wings or engineering degree, but rises through the ranks thanks to her vision for a more sustainable and accessible space program.
I really liked how she chose to label each part of her book. Part one, gravity, just sets the stage. It's about entrenched forces resisting change, NASA bureaucracy, legacy contractors, and congressional inertia. Lori Garver enters this world pushing for reform, advocating a shift from traditional, expensive, government-run programs to agile commercial partnerships. This part reveals the inefficiencies of the old system, the resistance she faced, and the early groundwork laid for a new kind of space strategy under the Obama administration.
Part two, force, brings the pushback and the power moves. Here, Garver and her allies apply strategic and political force to overcome institutional inertia. She plays a key role in shaping Obama's NASA policy, retiring the space shuttle, canceling the Constellation program, and backing commercial crew initiatives. The result? Fierce opposition, intense drama, but ultimately real momentum. SpaceX starts proving itself, and the seeds of a new space age take root.
In part three, the final part, motion, is where it all takes off. The results begin to materialize: lower costs, faster innovation, and successful commercial launches. NASA's culture starts to shift. There's new players that enter the field, and commercial partnerships become not just viable, but vital. The future of space exploration starts to look different, more dynamic, more open, and more sustainable. This is the movement Garver envisioned, finally in motion.
Together, gravity, force, and motion tell a story of resistance, struggle, and breakthrough. The transformation of America's space program from a government monopoly to a vibrant 21st century ecosystem with commercial companies playing a leading role in American space power.
What's interesting is the drama she tries to build in her narration. In fact, the prologue begins with a physical threat on her life, pointing the reader to believe that it was the result of her decision to push for Mars via the Curiosity mission over extending the shuttle missions. The stakes are not just policy, they're personal.
And that drama is where the book really shines. Garver helped shape President Obama's NASA strategy, which included retiring the space shuttle, canceling the troubled Constellation program, and shifting to commercial partnerships to reach low Earth orbit. Internal resistance from aerospace establishment, opposition from senators like Bill Nelson, and pushback from legendary astronauts like Neil Armstrong. She vividly describes how difficult change is, especially when billions of dollars are on the line. Josh, if you had to choose three key points from this text, what would they be?
The first would be her main thesis. NASA needs a pretty fundamental shift, especially regarding space transportation. Second, she's pushing for moving away from the traditional model of the government owning and operating everything because it stifles progress and is cost prohibitive. The last key point is that policy is an incredibly important driver for change in the space industry. The book picks up when she starts facing these challenges, trying to implement some of these ideas.
That's an excellent summary. So, what did we like about this book?
I'll kick it off. I love Garver's personal and candid nature. She doesn't sugarcoat the resistance from the old guard. That honesty makes the technical and policy content more relatable. Her overarching goal is to make space more accessible and sustainable. It's not just about a few astronauts going to the moon. It's about economic growth, national security, scientific advancement, and inspiration. This also isn't just some academic writing a book about space policy. This is someone who was in the trenches. You get a sense of the political and bureaucratic battles, the backroom deals shaping space policy.
Agreed. One of the most compelling elements of Garver's book is how she frames the ideological divide in the space world as a human story. She doesn't just talk about policies or programs, she talks about people and the kinds of people who shape the trajectory of space exploration. She splits them into two main camps, the NSIers and the L5ers.
Right, the NSIers, named after the old National Space Institute, representing the entrenched establishment. These are the cup boys, a term she used to describe traditional military and astronaut types who came up through NASA's inner circles, with the predisposition to oppose new ideas and new people. They're often more interested in preserving the old model of space as a government-dominated, contractor-heavy playground, rather than actually innovating or expanding access.
Then you got the L5ers, which she describes as the rebels. These folks came out of the L5 Society, a group that originally advocated for space settlement and sustainability. Garver paints them as the visionaries, idealists with a purpose beyond profit. They're the ones challenging the system, pushing for commercial innovation, sustainability, and saw the space shuttle as impeding progress.
She has a name for them too, space pirates. It starts as a kind of sci-fi reference, but by the end of the book, it's clear she means it seriously. These are the people who break rules, shake things up, and ultimately drive the change she believes NASA desperately needed. People like Elon Musk and Brian Kemp weren't always welcome in the room, but Garver argues she had to forcibly make room, as they were essential for breaking the mold. That idea of outsiders driving progress stuck with me. SpaceX was able to transport astronauts to the ISS for a fraction of the cost, an order of magnitude cheaper than previous missions. She talks about the cost of a Falcon Heavy launch compared to refurbishing just one SLS engine is crazy expensive.
Okay, but let's be honest. As inspiring as Garver's vision may be, she sometimes glosses over the commercialization risks. There's a fine line between innovation and deregulation.
Yeah, SpaceX is killing it right now, no doubt. But there's a lingering dilemma about what happens when profit becomes the main motivator in space. Exploration could easily give way to exploitation. That's why some of the public oversight still matters. Not to micromanage, but to make sure things like safety, long-term sustainability, and fair access don't get lost in a race to monetize orbit.
This is exactly Garver's concern, too. She wants the government to adapt and award the right things, but not let go. So it feels like something is missing when she never fully delves into the negative pressure of over-commercialization.
Right. Her concerns emphasize the negative impacts on the environment and how government policy needs to handle potential failures from increased space activities via commercialization. Those are definitely important points, ones that only the government can do. But I think those are largely secondary concerns from the unavoidable militarization and weaponization aspects of space. Things we've already learned about in other books we've read. What Bowen describes as the original sin of space assets is essentially their inherent military capability. They're just inescapable and symbolize real power.
She could have really made her point stronger had she been able to attack it head on, but she avoids that discussion entirely. To her credit, though, Garver at one point says that as a space pirate, she wants commercialization to take on proven technologies and do what they do best, drive down costs and access up. In a way that NASA can focus on being the leading edge, innovating pioneer, it proved to be so many times in the past. This makes sense to me, but her narrative oversimplifies the dilemma as simply policy change.
And one thing that bugged me a little, Garver writes a lot about being attacked. While I get the emotional toll, some parts felt a little like settling scores. Name dropping feels almost like name shaming. There are moments when the memoir's tone undercuts the objectivity. What really got me was her praise for Senator Mikulski, who says no military and no astronauts when talking about selection criteria for the new NASA administrator position. I was shocked by the overt bias to limit someone fully invested in the program because of their technical and operational background.
I also found this as another attempt to inflate her policy background as superior when she clearly emphasizes other astronauts like Buzz Aldrin and Neil Armstrong that fit her definition of a space pirate, focused on change, and were also military. She cherry-picks her favorites and then labels bad guys and good guys when it's convenient to her interpretation. It's so focused on her personal experiences, and so it does tend to highlight certain individuals and events and maybe gloss over others.
Exactly. There are a few times she's trying to make a point, and she loses the reader's confidence. For example, on page 35, she makes the point that what made Vice President Quayle a mover and shaker in space policy was that he didn't have a space or technical background, which made him and his staff less susceptible to being influenced or controlled by traditional interests. This makes a strong attempt at inflating her own abilities, which painfully self-mirrors the same things. I don't think the reader necessarily buys it.
She no doubt has some enemies. That's what makes it a high-stakes political battleground and a fun read. She settles comfortably on the idea that there is a cost for being the first one through the wall, as she quotes from Moneyball.
You have to take it with a grain of salt, right? Because she's the one telling the story. It would have been interesting to get the other side of the story a little more to understand their motivations. The book could have benefited from a more in-depth discussion of potential counterarguments, potentially complicating the problem as simply a commercialization approach.
Spot on observation. Some of the finer nuances of those policy debates might have gotten a little lost in the interest of keeping the story moving. Transitioning to space strategy, this book tells us a lot about the future of space strategy. Number one, agility matters. Big, slow, government-run programs haven't kept up with the rapid technological change. This book highlights the central tension that people, well-educated and appointed into important billets, can have profound influence, even regarding space power. It makes me think of Colin Gray's statement that policy, strategy, and tactics require clear distinctions.
Great point. We don't even have to be competing with other nations to lose the space race. We can defeat ourselves through weak government policies and internal resistance to change. That's one of the most striking things from this course. And escaping gravity brings it into sharp focus. Lori Garver shows just how vulnerable progress is when a small number of entrenched interests and personalities are allowed to steer national priorities. If commercial space hadn't broken through, we might still be stuck in a model that's high cost, low agility, and politically gridlocked. The fact that just a handful of advocates were able to tip the balance shows both how narrow the window was and how easy it would have been to miss it. And this ties right back to Eisenhower's farewell warning about the military-industrial complex. He feared that the growing power of defense contractors and their influence over government decisions would lead to misplaced priorities, runaway spending, and a national strategy driven more by profit and inertia than by innovation or necessity. In the context of space, we saw that exact dynamic at play. Huge contracts for underperforming programs, resistance to new ideas, and a deeply rooted fear of giving up control. What Garver helped do was pull the U.S. space program back from that edge, not by ignoring national power, but by rethinking how to build it.
For sure. It's a break from the whatever the enemy has, we must have, whatever the enemy doesn't have, we must also have mentality, towards a more deliberate approach to developing space strategy.
Cost reduction is everything. Garver argues that cheaper launches, enabled by commercial players, are key to unlocking space for science, defense, and even climate research. Her argument is reinforced by Ashley Vance's book, When the Heavens Went on Sale, where companies like Rocket Labs, Astra, and Firefly aim to produce launches much cheaper than has ever been done before. It supports the argument for greater commercialization.
And third, strategy isn't just about rockets. It's about leveraging the advantages of space that make it powerful. A critical node in enabling space infrastructure into national power really is about quality and institutions, and who's the president running the show. NASA had to evolve technologically and culturally, and Garver shows how hard that is when power, pride, and politics are involved.
It's not just about the technology. It's about the people, the politics, the whole system. Garver states the steel quadrangle, the industry, Congress, NASA bureaucracy, and academic scientists were all working together to maintain the status quo. Also, let's not overlook the geopolitical angle. The United States was paying Russia for rides to the ISS. That's wild. Space strategy truly is national strategy.
Okay, so great, Commercialization has a leading role in U.S. space power strategy today, and that's what makes us powerful. And that's great, but now it comes with other risks, other costs. Now people are concerned that Elon Musk has too much power. We're now fully reliant on SpaceX to lead U.S. space power. That's a little aggressive and potentially concerning for a national strategy in the long term.
Spot on. But as we're discussing in our class, the U.S. pivot to commercialization is now shaping how countries like China and Russia develop their space programs. Space strategy requires a delicate balancing act to prevent a space race. I find this increasingly important as the lines between the militarization and the weaponization of space become more blurred.
All right, to wrap up, let's hit our five key takeaways.
So first, I think bureaucracy is a frontier in itself. Transforming NASA took more political will than even technological skill, and that's a point Lori Garver makes pretty clearly. People with technical skill, people with background, were doing more to entrench the system, slow down the system, than continue its innovative trajectory.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the challenges of bureaucracy is that it's developed for a reason, but those reasons change, and sometimes you have to strip away those layers. As the commercial sector exploded in growth, the capability, low cost, and lower entry points to the space race, the bureaucracy has to change to be adaptive. I think that's one of the things that we're grappling with right now when we're seeing new companies like SpaceX, we're seeing Rocket Labs, we're seeing companies move to the United States for access to venture capital. Those are the type of things that we have to move quickly through the bureaucracy to enable the explosive growth that we want.
Seems common sense, right? Like, let's offload the routine stuff like space launch to commercial companies. But she did a good job of articulating how there was all these state interests that kind of prevented the intelligent, you know, choice. It was kind of frustrating, and I know we've read that a lot in a lot of her books. You know, we see it every day. But I agree. Like, bureaucracy was really well articulated in the book. Garver talked about how, you know, there's all these senators and who had vested interests in not necessarily the right decision for NASA in space, but it was what was the right decision for their state. And it kind of becomes frustrating because it seems so much common sense to offload the routine stuff. Like, if the commercial companies can do it cheaper, let them do that. Let NASA focus on science and space, you know, make better use of the budget. But just the bureaucracy kind of overruled common sense decisions is super frustrating.
What's nice about this book is that it is different from our heavy military strategy books about space, right? So she's not necessarily seeing space from a, you know, power perspective. She's not seeing it from like, well, because China has this capability, Intel tells us this, so we need to have this. It's not just a tit for tat type of deterrence approach. And, you know, that's an interesting part about her claim to be a space pirate. Even though she uses that word pirate, she's not trying to necessarily be reckless. She's just trying to pull people away from just using space as a military domain, a chance to compete. But really what she's looking for is to colonize space.
Yeah, I think that leads me into takeaway number two. Visionary outsiders matter. Entrepreneurs like Elon Musk and Richard Branson help push innovation faster than the traditional system ever could, but they also have different goals and objectives. If you look at SpaceX and Starlink, that's vastly different than the Virgin Galactic approach of space tourism. And even the way they build their architectures to achieve those objectives expand the capabilities across the gambit of the space infrastructure. And the barriers of entry, as they change for different entities trying to get into space, it drives innovation. You want to bring those outsiders inside, but you don't want the bureaucracy, like we talked about in the first takeaway, to bog them down. We want to enable growth. So I think when we're looking at bringing outsiders in, it's just about having that fresh perspective, challenging the status quo. Even though we're moving to commercialization, that may not be the best model to be the most efficient. I don't know how long people like Elon Musk had the idea of catching rockets to reuse them. But wow, now that we have it, what's the next thing? Is it slingshotting capabilities into space? How do we want to use low Earth orbit vice getting to geostationary orbit? So I just think we got to bring those outsiders in, but not bog them down with the bureaucracy that shapes the inside.
Yeah, and I think Lori Garver was a great example of a visionary outsider as well. She was able to go into the organization, deal with that old guard who didn't want to change their ways. So, her book details the challenge she had, but ultimately led to this commercialization that I think most people will agree is the best thing we can do for NASA and for space.
I really appreciate her emphasis on people, space actors, people with names and personalities, things you may not like or you do like. You know, all this is through her lens. We're trying to balance that, but a good point she doesn't quite delve in, but we've talked about in class, is that once you bring these people in, you give them power. To have the ability to launch rockets, to be able to affect space strategy is powerful. And so arguably, we don't want to give them a monopoly. Recently, I think yesterday, right, ULA finally was able to launch, was it the Vulcan? So, hey, we've at least got two players now. Now national policy can actually move and play off of both players because they have different goals. You know, one's supportive, the other one seems to be leading, trying to essentially pull the government into a certain type of strategy. Either way, I think it's good that we're expanding, relying on partners not within the bureaucracy.
Yeah, and for key takeaway number three, understanding your why can inspire progress. Garver worked hard to reignite a stalled human spaceflight program that focused too much on how and what that led to maintaining expensive government programs that failed to achieve usefulness for national goals. A great example of the why, back during the Cold War, our why was basically national prestige and defeating kind of the Soviet, you know, overcoming their prestige as well. So we had a why back then, but when the Cold War ended, we still maintained a NASA program that didn't focus on why. We didn't shift. We didn't have a shift. We didn't develop a new why. We just kept maintaining expensive programs that didn't focus on science or whatever we wanted to do next, which to the fault of the American taxpayer, I would say.
And I think the why is always changing, right? There's a why for now. There's a why for the 5 years out. There's a why for 20 years out. So I think this is something, as we talk about bringing in outsiders, diversifying our supply chains, having more capability and different interests in the space domain, that is something that we need to consider. At what point is our why evolving? Is it why for space strategy in regards to protecting infrastructure? Is it why towards expanding tourism, space tourism, as it becomes cheaper? We gotta keep in mind that our whys can change.
I really like that, what you both said. You know, we're talking about vision here. Strategy doesn't have to be just stuck in a Cold War mindset. You know, maybe that was effective, but if we're going to evolve and adapt, we need to be thinking bigger. And Garver alludes to this, is a lot of that relies on what people think. To push that into policy, you got to have people that are thinking that, and then there has to be some kind of consent or cooperation to give that kind of idea momentum, to give it power. But she tries to call out, like, people with technical skills or operational backgrounds, just because of their background alone doesn't make them necessarily the right person to have vision. And I think we've seen that too, you know, within our own professions. Once people get comfortable, they don't want to think as big anymore. They kind of want to just be happy with the status quo. And that may work for a little while, right? When you don't have other people pushing you or other countries necessarily setting the pace, you can kind of just coast for a little while. But that is completely against what NASA is. And she's very clear and very articulate in her ability to point that out. And I appreciate that about her. As much as I am concerned about policy only, that she does make a great example of that. People with only a policy background were able to actually make significant changes in an otherwise stalled program. Key takeaway number four, sustainability is part of the future. From climate research to reusable rockets, space must serve long-term societal goals if it's to be effective. And usually when I think about sustainability, I don't really find that as innovative, right? That's not like the most interesting part of a dynamic policy. She talks about climate research, but then she also mentions things like reusable rockets. Whether you like it or not, it has to serve long-term societal goals. That's not necessarily always the case, but if you can tie it back to that, that's what allows consensus, that's what allows cooperation, and that also builds your narrative, right? Which is gonna just increase the number of people that are able to support, able to articulate why a powerful space program is so important for our nation. Turns out, you know, it can be both. It can be both focused on increasing terrestrial security as well as seek to improve and expand human life beyond Earth's atmosphere. And I like that. I like that about the book.
Yeah, that's a great point. She does a great job of highlighting sustainability. And like you said, you don't necessarily think of that when you think of innovation. You know, and along the lines of that theme, you know, that debris removal, I think, is another example of sustainability where we need to kind of take that on to ensure that space is sustainable. And it fits well with that theme, reusable rockets and climate research. And it's just something that space policy needs to think about.
So I'll go into the last takeaway. Change is painful, but it's necessary. If you're trying to escape gravity, whether literally or metaphorically, you're going to go against some resistance. And I feel like that's something that we have to be mindful of, because as we're talking about building out a strategy, we're not the only nation. Other nations are going to react to the strategy we're building. And in that, we start to react to what they're doing. And so just being cognizant of the changing environment as we make decisions on how we want to utilize space, how others want to utilize space, what are our partnerships, what are our alliances, we're going to encounter some resistance. We're going to encounter some issues with trying to share the narrative of why we're doing what we're doing as a nation. But ultimately, the way to navigate change is being transparent and having clear goals and objectives. And if we can do that, we can explain to our national base why space is important, our reliances on space, and even remove some reliances from space if we have to deal with any type of contestation in the space domain.
I think if Lori was here, she'd potentially say that, you know, colonizing or expanding space is good for mankind, right? It's good for everybody. That's a narrative that we can all agree on as humans, that even if you're saying, right, that you want to expand beyond Earth for all these noble reasons for the good of mankind, the fact that anything that we launch into space has that inherent dual-use capability makes it threatening. It's going to have reactions to it. And we're going to see China, for example, act in a neo-realist way that seeks to improve their security. So the United States needs to be aware of that. As we expand, as we explore, it may just trigger an arms race in space as well. So the United States has to be, like what you said, transparent. We've got to be clear in our goals. We have to be accepting that other nations may not see those in the same benevolent way that we wish.
Yeah, great point with your key takeaway number five, change is painful. I think she does a, you know, incredible job with the way she organized her book that kind of demonstrates, you know, overcoming the resistance to change and all the pain she dealt with from gravity to force to motion throughout her book. I picture the meme of the, you know, the miner who's like digging his long tunnel and on the other side is the diamonds, but he gives up right before he achieved what he was trying to get. That's just the way it is, you know, and she did a great job of, pursuing the end of the space shuttle program, which we didn't need anymore, the abandonment of the Constellation program, which was super expensive, and the transition to this commercial crew concept where commercial companies are now doing our space flight. So had she gave up, if it kind of got overwhelmed with all the pain, we'd still have an expensive NASA program that wasn't achieving anything. So she dealt with the pain and she made positive change. So it's necessary.
This isn't the last time that we're going to change, right? Just because they changed successfully at this point doesn't mean that we're not going to change again and again and again. Parts of the government or the system itself were made for a certain reason with certain assumptions, and that's great. They don't have to be permanent. We can change and we can adapt and we can ultimately try to open our arms and embrace as many people as possible into allowing this thing to be effective and successful. It doesn't have to be just the astronauts. You know, those aren't the people, the only people with credence. How much better would it be if everyone is now in line, the policymaker, the policy visionary, as well as the operators, and then the next generation? Now that gives your whole nation momentum as opposed to a niche group of people, which are limited based on these certain educational qualifications alone.
And to conclude, that's it for today's episode of Orbital Minds. Escaping Gravity provides a unique voice to our discussions about space power. It's a nice, leisurely read that provides a ground-level perspective for anyone who wants to get involved at the policy level or anyone who cares about the future of space, innovation, or even just how hard it is to push change through Washington.
Whether you agree with her or not, Lori Garver is a critical figure in 21st century space policy development. Her book will leave you thinking and maybe even fired up, but you don't need a PhD in physics to understand it.
Be sure to subscribe, leave a review, and tell us what space book we should cover next. Until next time, keep looking up.